Great. Well, thank you very much. So, yeah, I mean, I thought it was going to be great for my career to be the first American tried by the ICC. But I managed to make it here to the Lauterpacht even without spending time in jail in The Hague. So I really appreciate the invitation to speak and the kind introduction. So, in order to not let people down, I'll start by saying that I think it's becoming harder and harder to deny that the ICC today is in something of a crisis. No longer do we hear the soaring hyperbole that used to characterize the Office of the Prosecutor's statements, especially those of Luis Moreno Ocampo, Ban Ki-moon's declaration that the ICC marks, quote, a fundamental break with history and that the old era of impunity is over sounds increasingly like fantasy. And so today, of course, what's in the news instead, especially over the last couple weeks, as Sarah mentioned, is South Africa's declaration that it's going to withdraw from the court, following on Burundi, followed by the Gambia, and suddenly it seems that perhaps African states' threat to withdraw from the court en masse might become a reality. Now, of course, this is just the latest in the ICC's litany of difficulties. Over the last 2 years, the court has come under intense criticism for its lack of results. This came to a reached a height at the end of 2014 with the collapse of the Kenyatta case, which also came on the heels of the suspension of the case against Omar al-Bashir. And so even among the ICC's liberal supporters, these failures set off a tough round of questioning and often self-doubt. Do 4 convictions, it's argued, justify the ICC's 14 years of work and $1 billion spent? A quick tally of the situations in which the ICC is involved shows 31 arrest warrants, 7 people in detention. As many suspects have died waiting for their trial as have been convicted. And even if convictions stand under appeal, all 4 men could be released within 5 years. Even the New York Times recently went after Chief Prosecutor Moreno Ocampo for leading the ICC into disaster, a headline asking, quote, is the War Crimes Court still relevant? And so while the ICC's apparent failure to get anything done has cast its liberal supporters into self-doubt, what the court has done has met with the opprobrium of more radical critics. ICC's political selectivity in where it intervenes has given weight to accusations that it's a tool of the powerful. The court's humiliation in the Kenya case, its apparent inability to prosecute anyone except minor African rebel commanders and former African heads of state who have been overthrown by Western military intervention, have shown the really dramatic limitations of whom the ICC can prosecute. It's been accused of ruining peace processes, undermining amnesties, even those with democratic mandates, entrenching, intensifying conflicts, undermining the local pursuit of justice, exploiting victims, and of course being racist, neocolonialist, and merely a Western court to judge Africa. All the while, the court itself insists on increasingly untenable arguments to justify the conformity of its prosecutorial decisions with strict legality, what Frederick McGray has called, quote, opportunistic pragmatism masquerading as responsible technocracy. And so, if African states do withdraw from the ICC, it could render future investigations in the continent almost impossible, given the need for cooperation that the ICC has shown thus far. And since the ICC seems primarily interested, or almost exclusively interested, in Africa, it could leave the court with little to do at all. Now, at this crucial moment in the history of international criminal law, the moment when the institution that had been thought to be the consummation of international criminal law is falling into crisis, the African Union, which has had no small part in creating that crisis, is forging ahead with a plan to create its own continental international criminal court, what's been nicknamed the African Criminal Court, or ACC. So technically, the ACC is the proposed international criminal section of the African Court of Justice and Human Rights. Now, the African Court of Justice and Human Rights was itself established by a 2008 protocol that merged the African Court on Human and People's Rights and the Court of Justice of the African Union into a single court. So the 2014 Malabo Protocol extends the jurisdiction of this merged court to include a third international criminal law section, that is the ACC. And the development of this African court is being driven on by a group of lawyers and officials within the African Union and in affiliated organizations, especially the AU's Legal Counsel, Director of Legal Affairs, and the Pan-African Lawyers Union. It's supported by a shifting constellation of African states, and so the Malabo Protocol may undergo further amendments as it tries to gather ratifications. So, at this point, whether the African Criminal Court will ever see the light of day is uncertain. But this uncertainty has not prevented a heated debate from erupting over the proposed court. And so this debate, this sort of dominant debate around the ACC, has pitted those who see the proposed African court as an important piece in an apolitical global legal architecture versus those who see it as a significant threat to that architecture because of its inescapable politicization. So for proponents of the ACC in this debate, the court can effectively fill gaps within the global architecture of international criminal law, a global architecture reaching from national courts through regional mechanisms up to the pinnacle, the ICC. Based on an expansive notion of complementarity, international criminal law is envisioned as being most effective when there's a multiplicity of courts with specific competences, providing a comprehensive web that ensures that no case escapes prosecution. This position has been most strongly voiced by the African Union, the AU, and it presents the ACC as a good faith effort by Africa to carry forward the fight against impunity. In this view, there's no politics to the African court beyond building international criminal law, closing the impunity gap, and providing justice to victims. Now, those are the supporters. For the ACC's critics, on the other hand, the court will necessarily be subject to intense and counterproductive politicization by African states and African political elites. Thus, these critics argue, politicization will lead an African criminal court to undermine the global rule of law, not contribute to it. The chief evidence for this, as those who followed the debate know, is the Malabo Protocol's head of state immunity provision, which has really dominated the debate so far over the proposed court. And so this argument against the African Criminal Court is often paired with a defense of the International Criminal Court, as critics denounce the ACC as a ploy by African leaders to guarantee themselves immunity from prosecution through an ineffective institution that they control. It's an argument that often carries the assumption that African sovereignty is little more than a shield for abusive leaders and elites against international human rights. Thus, according to this argument, there can be no principled African opposition to the ICC. In the words of Richard Dicker of Human Rights Watch, the AU's challenge to ICC prosecutions reveals that, quote, the AU leadership's objective was to roll back the fight against the most serious crimes under international law, and that African states' opposition to the ICC is thus, quote, a rejection of the fight against impunity. And those who have seen Luis Moreno Ocampo's most recent statement would know that he compares those African states who have argued against the ICC to Holocaust deniers. So the way that this debate is polarized and is moralized in very counterproductive ways. Now, what's important to note in this is that this debate is a debate between fundamentally legalist positions. The legalist supporters of the African court argue that the ACC can be insulated from politics and thus be part of an apolitical global legal architecture contributing to justice and peace. On the other hand, legalist critics of the ACC argue that the proposed court will necessarily be politicized by African states and so will not be able to function as a proper apolitical court of law and will fail to deliver justice. And so while they disagree on whether the ACC will support or undermine the fight against impunity, both positions share the same legalist assumption that an international criminal court can contribute to justice and peace only if it's insulated from politics. And I think that this legalism, in Judith Sklar's sense of the word, has largely defined and delimited today's dominant debate over international criminal courts. But in this presentation, what I'd like to do is to try to go beyond this legalist framework and the central dichotomy of this framework, according to which international criminal law is either insulated from politics and thus an effective agent of justice and peace, or it is politicized, corrupted and rendered ineffectual or worse. And instead, I'd like to follow the path that was laid out by Sklar 50 years ago, who recognized the inevitable political nature of international criminal tribunals. She argued that tribunals will necessarily contribute to upholding certain political orders or enforcing certain political agendas. Thus, neither the proposed African Criminal Court nor the International Criminal Court can even be the apolitical institutions that their legalist champions make them out to be. But by the same token, the fact that international courts are inevitably political does not mean that they will necessarily be corrupted and unable to bring about justice or peace, as the court's legalist critics maintain. That is, the fact that international criminal tribunals are politicized does not mean that all politicizations are the same. How a court is politicized, what political order it helps uphold or enforce, whether it supports or subverts justice and peace, all this will be determined by a complex interplay between the particular internal structure of the court with the external international political environment in which the court functions. So what I want to do in this paper, in this presentation, is to first look briefly at the politics of the ICC. And my argument is that due to the particular internal structure of the ICC, which is at heart a scaled-up domestic model intending to try atrocity crimes, and because of its external context, a global court in the age of a global war on terror, the ICC has ended up supporting unjust and violent political agendas in Africa. Now, I've written about this pretty extensively before, so I'm just going to present this very briefly. And then I turn my focus to the African Criminal Court. On the one hand, the ACC is, like the ICC, built on a scaled-up domestic model. But what I want to argue is that there are specific differences in terms of the internal structure of the ACC and its political context, which open the possibility, but provide no guarantee, for the proposed African court to contribute to an emancipatory politics, and perhaps even to provide for justice and peace in a way impossible for the ICC. And so what I want to try to do is to shift the debate on the African Criminal Court, and perhaps on other tribunals as well, shift the debate beyond the legalist concern with whether the ACC will be politicized and thus will uphold or undermine a fight against impunity. Instead of debating whether politics will shape the proposed African court, because politics will inevitably shape the court, the debate we need to have is over what political agenda and what orientation should determine the court's operation and how that can be made a reality. Admitting the inevitability of politicization can allow for open debate over what those politics should be and how courts can be held accountable by those in whose name they act, instead of allowing international criminal tribunals to reject accountability by invoking their supposedly purely legal nature. So domestic criminal legal systems, as everybody here knows, are assumed to entail a series of goods: ensuring justice for victims, enforcing a peaceful social order, promoting deterrence. And as the domestic criminal model is scaled up to the global level in the form of the ICC, it's assumed that these benefits, justice, legitimacy, order, deterrence, will also be replicated globally. But as critics from John Bolton on the right to Danilo Zolo on the left have argued, the foundation that ensures the efficacy and legitimacy of the domestic criminal legal model, which is a sovereign state and a political community of citizens, are of course absent on the global level. Now, the most obvious consequence of this absent political foundation is in terms of efficacy. The attempt to enforce international criminal law without a sovereign global state leads to the selective application of the law due to the lack of consistent and independent enforcement capacity. And not surprisingly, we've seen the ICC conforming to global, regional, and national lines of power in its desperate quest for enforcement. I think the problem is that the ICC was conceived of in the exuberant humanitarianism of the 1990s, but it was born in the age of the war on terror. And so, as a lot of people, as we all know, the ICC faced vehement opposition from the US when it was founded, And so the court, thinking itself under grave threat before it had even started its first case, decided it would have to conform to U.S. interests if we're to have a chance of surviving. You read John Bosco's rough, or not John, David Bosco's rough justice on this. So the ICC responded by making clear that it would target what was represented as meaningless African violence, the non-political violence of African warlords and greedy rebellions, not the violence of the U.S. and its allies. And so the first defining case for the ICC, launched at the very moment when these U.S. invasions and occupations were raging, was not Iraq or Afghanistan, but the DRC. Because as ICC Registrar Bruno Cathala said, it was the ICC's job to go after, quote, the most serious crimes and not, quote, silly things like Iraq. And so Africa, and in particular Central Africa, became the sole remaining object of the 1990s humanitarian imaginary of a human rights world order and human rights enforcement, the only remaining place where the ICC could pretend that violence was outside of politics and in need of non-political humanitarian intervention. And so Africa has played a key role in the ICC's development, as ICC intervention into Africa in the name of rescuing humanity from atrocity allowed the ICC to legitimate itself, to claim to be achieving its world historical mission and avoid US censure post 9/11. Now, the history of the ICC within Africa has also been a history of the ICC's constant effort to align itself with Western, in particular US support, avoid Western censure, and also gain the support of cooperative African states. We've seen the court align itself with the military force of the US in Libya, Uganda, Darfur, with the force of France in Cote d'Ivoire or Mali. And we've seen it align itself also with authoritarian African states, such as Uganda. In every case, the ICC offers de facto immunity to those states in exchange for cooperation. Now, for their part, once states realized that the ICC was willing to cut deals, Western and African states have taken advantage of the court, often blatantly instrumentalizing it to their own political interests. Now, the court and its supporters often try to obscure this reality by attributing enforcement to a so-called international community. But this is an ideological move, covering the fact that enforcement is determined not by the objective application of the law, but by global power politics. Equally important for the ICC are the problems that stem from the lack of a political community of citizens at the global level that can be the source of the law and to whom the law is accountable. Again, the court's supporters tend to claim that there is a global community that the ICC is serving, that is, humanity. And there are rights-bearing subjects to whom it's accountable, that is, victims. But again, these are far too thin to compensate for a missing sovereign citizenry. There's no concrete content to the concept of humanity or victim, as there is with a national political community of citizens. There's no way that humanity or victim can be the bases for concrete political visions or programs. No set of enforceable legal rights that can enable them to be the source of the law and to hold the court accountable. And so when participation or accountability is demanded of the court, the ICC can claim that it is accountable to victims or to humanity, but of course, because victims by definition are voiceless and helpless, invoking the victim becomes a convenient way for the ICC to ventriloquize its own decisions onto Africans. And as we know, as Schmidt said, he who invokes humanity wants to cheat. And so the proclaimed basis of the ICC's universality in a humanity of victims serves to obscure the international inequality and violence that actually shape ICC practice. And as a result, under the ideology of protecting humanity and enforcing victims' rights, the substantive politics of the ICC's supposedly apolitical legal engagement with Africa has been to reinforce the relation of subordination between Africa and the West by declaring African sovereignty to be subject to coercive disqualification by an arbitrary international institution, while, equally importantly, often entrenching the power of authoritarian and violent African states. Now, a second dimension of the ICC's substantive politics stems from its exclusive jurisdiction over atrocity crimes. Because the crimes that the ICC has jurisdiction over, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, are so extreme and morally charged The ICC's practice cannot help but be endowed with a polarizing logic of friend-enemy, and Sarah has written about this quite a bit. And so the ICC can end up polarizing and intensifying situations of political violence, raising the stakes in dangerous ways, and often in the interests of those who benefit from prolonged or intensified conflict. And once again, this tendency further exacerbates the pathologies caused by the ICC's political selectivity. So in short, given the ICC's lack of enforcement capacity, lack of accountability, and exclusive jurisdiction over atrocity crimes, politicization has been the condition of possibility for the ICC to function at all. But at the same time, its proclamation of its apolitical legality ends up only hiding the actual substantive political determination of the ICC's law enforcement. And so it can't be held accountable. Now, the proposed African Criminal Court replicates much of the internal structure and external context of the ICC, sometimes through cut and paste. It too is built on a scaled-up domestic model. It has no independent enforcement capacity, has jurisdiction over atrocity crimes, and there's no concrete mechanisms for democratic accountability, and of course it too is operating in an international context fraught by inequality and violence. So perhaps we might expect it to replicate the same political pathology seen with the International Criminal Court, just on a continental scale. But what I want to argue is that there are specific aspects of the African Court's internal structure and external context that open at least the possibility, but certainly provide no guarantee, for the court to be shaped by more emancipatory political orientations, and thus possibly be in the service of justice and peace on the continent. That is, an African court may be subject to an emancipatory politicization in a way that the ICC cannot be. Now, one such orientation that can shape the African court is what we might call a state-centered Pan-Africanism. This orientation frames the African Criminal Court not as within a global legal architecture, as the legalists do, but rather as part of a continental peace and security architecture. An architecture focused upon the African Union and underpinned by a commitment to realize lasting peace and overcome Africa's legacy of violence. And so justice in this political framework, continental political framework, is not the narrow criminal justice for mass atrocity, but is rather a broader transitional justice, what Kamari Clark has called African ecologies of justice. The role of criminal trials would be determined by concerns of securing lasting peace and justice instead of by uncompromising demands for trials in the name of ending impunity. And so the integration of the proposed African court into this continental architecture has been made possible by the development of the AU's peace and security capacity over the last decade, the AU's commitment to a more interventionist peace agenda, and the Malabo Protocol entrenches the African Criminal Court within this multi-layered continental peace and security architecture. Grants referral power to the AU Assembly of Heads of State and Government and to the AU Peace and Security Council, declares the ACC complementary to regional courts. It fails to explicitly mention any role for the ICC or the UN Security Council. And of course, by being one of the three sections of this broader court, this could mean that the daily operations of the court and the professional and epistemic communities of its staff may themselves be infused by a broader sensibility, a broader vision of continental peace and justice, which then helps shape their decisions. Now, the Malabo Protocol's expanded subject matter and personal jurisdictions also create novel possibilities for the court to contribute to a continental peace and security agenda. First, as a lot of people probably know, the proposed African Criminal Court claims jurisdiction over an expanded set of crimes beyond those comprised by the Rome Statute. The Malabo Protocol includes the illicit exploitation of natural resources, mercenaries, corruption, trafficking in hazardous wastes, all of which have been issues that the African Union has sought to address for years, if not for decades. And so many people have argued that crimes which are of particular interest to Africa have been enshrined in the mandate of the African Criminal Court, and that addressing these non-atrocity crimes may help prevent atrocity crimes, as Charles Jallo has argued. Furthermore, by expanding the court's remit beyond atrocity crimes, this could help lessen the tendency towards the moralization and political polarization of the situations into which the African Criminal Court intervenes. So intervention may help diffuse tense political situations instead of escalating them. Now, the personal jurisdiction of the African Court is also expanded. For one thing, it includes not just natural persons, but also corporations. And it also includes non-Africans when, quote, the victim of the crime is a national of an African state party. So this expansion of jurisdiction opens a new range of political possibilities through the law. The African Court claims jurisdiction over not just atrocity crimes committed by Africans against Africans, which is what the ICC has in effect done, but rather over atrocity crimes as well as the broader range of crimes that accompany violence and conflict in Africa. It claims jurisdiction over the global networks of individual states and corporations that are complicit in that violence. And these crimes, from environmental devastation to corruption to illegal trafficking, are hidden when the focus is only on those Africans who are deemed most responsible, or in practice, most available for the most spectacular atrocities. So as opposed to the ICC, which takes violence in Africa and then singles out a handful of Africans upon whom it places responsibility, the African Court, due to its expanded jurisdiction, can perhaps delineate more complex and accurate global narratives of those responsible for violence, potentially contributing more effectively to peace and to justice. Furthermore, due to the fact that African states and organizations will themselves have to live with the consequences of the African Court's actions, as opposed to the ICC, which can wash its hands of any particular situation without any repercussions, perhaps the African Court will have to be more accountable for the outcomes of its interventions. And of course, for their part, African states won't be able to reject the African Court as simply a Western conspiracy. So this proposed African Court in this framework entails a possible radical change in international criminal law's role in mediating Africa's relation with the rest of the world. The ICC has helped legitimate Western intervention and interference and uphold the violent power of unaccountable African states. International criminal law as embodied in the African Criminal Court instead could become part of a long-standing African agenda in international law, which, in the words of legal scholar Roland Cole, can be, quote, traced back to the struggle for independence, the articulation of Pan-African doctrine, with its central focus on dignity, self-determination, and establishing sovereign equality for African states within the international community, what I identify as a state-centered Pan-Africanism focused on the AU. And so this, in a sense, is the substantive politics that could be advanced by the African Court's more immediate political focus on ensuring lasting peace and transitional justice. The African Court thus has the potential to serve a counter-hegemonic political vision founded on self-determination and sovereign equality for Africa, a vision that many African scholars argue has informed Africa's aspirations for international law since decolonization. But of course, this state-centered Pan-Africanism is not without its tensions. And these tensions are perhaps most clearly illuminated by the controversy over the Malabo Protocol's provision of head of state immunity in Article 46A. So on the one hand, one might argue that in an international context defined by major imbalances of power and resources, and in which the West often arrogates to itself the authority to effect regime change in the global South, the Malabo Protocol's declaration that African heads of state will not be subject to politically motivated prosecution is crucial if African self-determination is to have any substantive meaning, if political dignity and the integrity of the continent are to be upheld. But of course, on the other hand, providing immunity to heads of state, and even more so to an amorphous group of, quote, senior state officials, as it does, the Malabo Protocol also shows how the African Court may end up replicating the worst of the ICC's problems, being a tool wielded by African regimes against political opposition, or even by the West against African opponents. And of course, the African Criminal Court, without its own enforcement capacity, has to depend on member states. And so we'll face the familiar pressures to pursue politically viable cases, to conform its prosecutorial practice to pragmatic considerations. The Malabo Protocol also allows the African court to seek the, quote, cooperation or assistance of partners of the African Union, which is usually a euphemism for Western military force, which raised the specter of the African court serving as a subcontractor for Western security interests, a trend that's been seen with some African Union peacekeeping operations in recent years. And the fact that the protocol also allows for state referrals opens the ACC to the kind of politically motivated self-referrals that have plagued the ICC. Now, in the case of the African court, this is exaggerated because of head of state immunity, which allows states to make referrals to the court without even the possibility that the African court might prosecute the referring state's own crimes. So whereas the ICC offered de facto immunity to heads of state that referred crimes, with the African court, it has de jure immunity to those states. Now, the Malabo Protocol's expansion of crimes also has the potential to serve the interests of authoritarian states, inclusion of terrorism, unconstitutional changes of government, the possibility that change of government due to popular uprising could be criminalized. All of these also open the way for security states to use the protocol for their own interests. And so the ACC will unavoidably face pressure to be incorporated into existing networks and alignments of power that are both within Africa and globally. The existence of the African court could even render international criminal law more arbitrary, as the ambiguities of an inconsistent set of regional and global institutions can be manipulated by those with the power to do so. And there's, of course, the constant threat that the African Criminal Court, in pursuit of enforcement and Western support, might itself sign up for the global war on terror and become part of the developing transnational networks of unaccountable military and police violence that are forming across the continent, reinforcing African security states and Western security regimes, not challenging them. So what I want to argue is that if the ACC's progressive political possibilities are to be realized, this state-centered Pan-African orientation needs to be complemented by what we might call a people-centered Pan-Africanism, enabling the court's accountability, which would enable the court's accountability to African popular organizations, struggles, and communities. Now, what makes this possible is, in fact, the most obvious difference between the African court and the international court: African court's location in Africa. Being within Africa provides the context for a tenuous political community to emerge on the continental level, or really for a diversity of popular political forces and movements speaking in the name of an African community that can demand accountability from the court. And this is made possible by the fact that Africa as a region has a history of continental solidarity, shared legacies of emancipatory struggles and ideals, which have been instrumental in the realization of self-determination. It's a continent with a common experience being subject to a violent international order and to long processes of destructive foreign interference. It has a history of popular efforts at continental political unity and Pan-Africanism, which bears within it emancipatory progressive possibilities that are constantly being drawn upon to challenge more authoritarian interpretations of continental unity or national identity. Now, this, of course, is radically distinct from what exists on the global level. As I addressed earlier, the ICC functions in a global context characterized not by shared histories, but rather by a long history of inequality and domination. And so the ICC seeks to avoid accountability by claiming for itself the exclusive right to speak for humanity, victims, or global justice. But an African court cannot escape accountability in this way so easily. It's much harder for a Pan-African criminal court to cheat. Instead of the ICC's voiceless humanity and victims, with the African court, it's real social movements, actually existing popular struggles, and civil society organizations that can and do speak for themselves, who make demands on the African court in the name of Africa. Furthermore, the African court's expanded jurisdiction, it represents a new opportunity in terms of the kinds of claims that can be made on the court by social and political movements, struggles, and organizations. Whereas the anti-atrocity agenda narrowed the scope of global justice to the agency of the ICC, now the potential scope of the law is expanded and a broad array of different social, political, economic, and environmental forms of violence and oppression and injustice can be brought within the remit of global justice and legal or political remedy. This kind of global injustice beyond atrocity means that once it is not helpless victims being made to speak and its actual social movements and political struggles who speak for themselves, their demands may go far beyond the anti-impunity agenda or may even reject it in favor of other goals. And so even if the African court never actually carries out prosecutions in response to demands made by popular struggles, even if it never really gets off the ground, its mere existence is important because it creates a site around which plural, radical demands for justice beyond the anti-impunity atrocity agenda can be made and granted legitimacy. No longer can they be dismissed out of hand. An African court tells African social movements and struggles that they can decide for themselves what global justice means today, what comprises an international crime, whom should be held accountable. And this can then become part of an important part of further organization and struggle. The African court can thus help transform imaginations or ideas about what is accepted as normal, what's challenged, what is inside and beyond the scope of justice, opening the debate over global justice to broad plural determination. So to conclude, the African court offers the possibility, but clearly no guarantee, of articulating and advancing a substantive emancipatory politics based on a vision of Africa as a continent with histories of violence committed against it with impunity, but also histories of multiple struggles to secure self-determination and justice in the face of that violence. The African Criminal Court could give legal embodiment to those long-standing demands for justice for that legacy of violence. And in these ways, the African Court offers at least the possibility of being in the service of a counter-hegemonic political project. But the African Court will only be able to achieve this, or will be able to achieve this only if it's open to the demands and claims made by popular movements, struggles, and civil societies. And this will occur only if those movements and struggles demand that the court be accountable to them. Because obviously the state elites and AU technocrats who are currently deciding the shape of the court have no necessary interest themselves in making it democratically accountable, nor does it even sort of come on their radar, as I found. Now, my feeling is that contemporary political developments may be laying a foundation for just such demands of accountability, particularly the broad uprising of new forms of protest and social struggle throughout the continent, what I've called a third wave of African uprisings. These developments, these political developments, can ground alternative understandings of international law and justice, and state-centric models of international criminal law can perhaps be qualified by the recognition of social movements and struggles as themselves sources of international law. And so I think that African lawyers, academics, and activists, and non-African academics, lawyers, and activists who are involved in the court can look to social movements and struggles as proposing new ways of doing international justice and imagining ways to make international justice responsive and accountable to those it claims to serve. Upon that basis, African discourses and institutional experiments around the African court may be able to help reform dominant understandings of international criminal justice more generally, opening new possibilities that have been foreclosed by atrocity-centered international criminal law. The African Court may help catalyze a process by which international criminal law comes increasingly to be understood as a fragmented, multicentric terrain in which multiple histories weave together within a broad ethical political framework. International law as embodied in the ACC or elsewhere will thus be only one part of broader political struggles, one tool among many used by progressive political forces in the service of emancipation. And so to return to the crisis that the ICC finds it in itself in today, perhaps international criminal law, even if not the ICC, may have the chance to escape its present crisis if it begins from a recognition of the plurality of political struggles for justice around the world today, and it engages with those struggles in dialogue and solidarity instead of seeking to evade accountability through the denial of its own inescapably political character. Thank you.